Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your host, Diana, here with you every Saturday to bring you the news and top stories from the Military Times, your independent news source about your military. Well, for today's recording, since it is Valentine's Day after all, and next Monday is also President's Day, I thought I would reflect a little bit more on military history. So here are a few articles from the military history section of the Military Times, some of which concern Valentine's Day, and others for their significant connection to the month of February. Starting with this article provided to us by the Observation Post, "Woo your significant other this Valentine's Day with the help of some World War II acronyms." For those who are romantically inclined to celebrate Valentine's Day this weekend, skip the tired Be Mine cards and really woo your significant other with some historic body acronyms. Drawing on inspiration from World War II letters, let your partner know how you really feel with acronyms such as MALAYA or M-A-L-A-Y-A. My ardent lips await your arrival. Or, if you're feeling bold, BURMA, so B-U-R-M-A. Be undressed and or upstairs, ready, my angel. During the war, so many letters were being written, they were taking up space in much-needed wartime transport. Judy Barrett Litoff, a history professor at Bryant University, told History.com, "In order to address this problem, what the government did was encourage Americans to write V-mails. Written on one side of an 8x11.5-inch card, soldiers and their loved ones got around the new size restrictions by using inventive acronyms to get their ardor across." Now, while wartime restrictions no longer apply, if putting pen to paper to express your feelings is difficult for you, these handy acronyms are sure to do the trick. If you are feeling poetic, however, and you want to issue pithy messages, you can take a page out of soldier Chris Barker's book and skip the acronyms altogether and go straight for the direct approach. Sailing to Athens on October 27, 1944, Barker told his partner, Bessie, in no uncertain terms, exactly what he wished to do to her in this very NSFW letter, not safe for work letter. You're welcome. What follows is a selection from My Dear Bessie, a love story in letters, between Chris Barker and Bessie Moore, edited and introduced by Simon Garfield. 10th of December, 1944. I had not planned to write you again so soon, or to hear from you again, but your letter, number 58, was dropped today, and eagerly I gulped the manna that was in it. Quickly, I must respond to your apparent need of me. It is no good me trying to kid you that I know very well how Londoners must feel under the swift threat of the rockets. You do know that I went through the Blitz in 1940, but this is quite a small thing, a tangible thing, against present horrors. I believe that Zola worked in a coal mine for 6 months to get the atmosphere for his novel Germinal. I should have to hear at least one rocket before it really came home to me that there were such things. Similarly, you'd need to live in the desert to understand the actuality of miles and miles of sand. In other words, imagination cannot take us all the way. Yours, try as it may, cannot conjure up my present situation. You just rather naturally suppose the worst. I do hope that you will not get too downhearted about your present mode of living. You must always remember that it is the world and not you that is wrong and at fault. So when you feel desperately tired and unhappy about bombs, the weather, your colds, and other ills, don't take them as personal deficiencies. Remember, you are not responsible for them. Try and do as I have told you in the past, what I do now that I'm in the Army. think about things as little as possible, and remember that no amount of worrying can alter them. The grim happenings here would perhaps have more worried me had I been a civilian in London, but for us, more than anyone, life will be grand in the days to come if we will it so, if we trust. I shall come back to England, an England that I knew and in my fashion loved. Have you ever been chestnutting at Sunningdale in October or blackberrying at Carterham in September? And I shall brighten up your scene, I hope, and make you see things in a new and better light, so that we both must realize we had not lived till we met, till we loved. You are a little, I think, unduly anxious about my possible conduct away from you. In the desert, there was no temptation, and the chaps behaved well. Here, the married men vie with the single men in their enthusiasm for the new life. I can assure you that I have nothing but contempt for those who break pledges, either to their wives or their sweethearts. You are my sweetheart. I am pledged to you. I love you. There's no need for you to worry further. Probably I spend too much time contemplating you, but it is always you that I do contemplate. It is your warm beauty that I want to lie upon, to rub against, between your legs, that I want to come. I want to touch you between your legs. I want to feel your hands upon my privates. Tomorrow it will be lovely, for I will be with you. I want you. I love you. Chris. That was a selection from My Dear Bessie, A Love Story in Letters. Now, back to the article. And if your guy or gal is anything like Bessie, who wrote back, "Darling, I have no complaints about your letters. I am too happy that it is my body that you want, that occupies your thoughts." Well, then your heartfelt letter is sure to be well received. And if you're looking for further inspiration for a Valentine's Day card or letter you would like to give to a significant other or someone you're interested in, here are a couple of fun acronyms that you can send them. These include France, Friendship Remains and Never Can End. Italy, I Trust and Love You. Holland, Hope Our Love Lasts and Never Dies. Swalk, spelled S-W-A-L-K, sealed with a loving kiss. Malaya, My Ardent Lips Await Your Arrival. Burma, Be Undressed and or Upstairs, Ready My Angel. Ooh, this one. Venice, Very Excited, Now I Caress Everywhere. And finally, China, Come Home, I'm Naked Already. All right, and for those who would rather be gagged with a spoon than celebrate Cupid's Day, perhaps a Dear John letter will soothe your cold, black heart. And speaking of Dear John letters, this from the Library of Congress blogs, Folklife Today, American Folklife Center, and Veterans History Project, Telling Dear John Stories, VHP Collections in Action. The following is a guest post by Dr. Susan Carruthers, professor of history at the University of Warwick and author of several books, including Dear John, Love and Loyalty in Wartime America, Cambridge University Press, 2022. She used Veterans History Project collections in her research for this volume and also in research for her previous publication, The Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace, Harvard University Press, 2016. In October 1943, 24-year-old Milton Bracker, already a seasoned war correspondent, reported from North Africa on an alarming new phenomenon. His story in the New York Times Sunday magazine began with an uncontroversial claim. Separation was the, quote, one of the most dominant war factor in the lives of most people these days, but regrettably, the old adage, absence makes the heart grow fonder, was more often disproved than validated, the reporter claimed. Wherever dour dog faces found themselves in alien settings like Algiers, Dear John clubs were springing up. Bracker explained these as mutual consolation societies formed by officers and enlisted men who had received letters running something like this. Dear John, I don't know quite how to begin, but I just want to say that Joe Doakes came to town on furlough the other night and he looked very handsome in his uniform, so when he asked me for a date. GI slang for a breakup note from a girlfriend, fiancé, or wife, the Dear John, entered civilian circulation in 1943. The coinage has been in use ever since. Over several decades and successive wars, it seems just about every man in uniform, real or imaginary, received a Dear John at some point in his service, from Gomer Pyle to MASH's radar, and from grunts on Hamburger Hill to jarheads in the Gulf. Although the Dear John quickly became a dominant feature of wartime's emotional landscape, it's well-nigh impossible to find extant specimens in the archives. Researching a book on the topic, I tried to do just that, only to come up empty-handed. Not surprisingly, unlike cherished love letters from home, Dear Johns tended to be quickly consigned to oblivion. Reeling from rejection, who clings onto a breakup note with a view to preserving it for posterity? What I soon realized was that rather than trying to piece together scattered fragments of a female epistolary genre, I do far better to approach the Dear John as a male oral tradition. Conversations with staff at the American Folklife Center helped crystallize this epiphany. After all, most of what we know about these notorious missives comes from the stories that men in uniform and veterans of the armed forces have told us about breakup notes and the women who write them. Thanks to the stellar sleuthing of senior reference specialist Megan Harris, I was able to watch and/or listen to well over 100 oral histories from the Veterans History Project, all containing a Dear John story, whether in passing or as the piece de resistance. One of my biggest surprises was just how varied these stories are, in substance and style alike. Even on the definition of a Dear John, veterans diverge. Some insist that this letter doesn't just end a relationship with the recipient, but, more woundingly yet, informs him that he's been supplanted by a new love. In some cases, revelation of this usurper's identity supplies the punchline. During World War II, the snake was likely to be a reviled 4F, sometimes a best friend or even a relative of the dumped serviceman. In Gene Shepard and Ferlin Husky's 1953 hit A Dear John Letter, released as an armistice brought conflict in Korea to a conclusion, it was John's brother, Don, who claimed the apologetic writer's affections. Veteran Gerard Streelman's story goes one better and had me laughing aloud in the Folklife Center when I first heard it. Streelman pivots to this anecdote, having just recounted a horrific suicide, also involving a Dear John, to his son, the interviewer. That he oscillates between registers, deftly supplanting tragedy with comedy, tells us a good deal about the flexibility of the Dear John genre. Far from sharing a common denominator of grievance or grief, they span the gamut of wartime experience, sometimes utterly wrenching, sometimes playfully humorous. Veterans besides Streelman remember distressing incidents in which young men took their own lives after receiving a Dear John. Interviewed at the age of 102, Sam Sachs recounts an episode of lethal self-harm from World War II, so vividly that it might have happened yesterday. Strikingly, Sachs doesn't condemn the young woman who severed ties with his soldier. She was young, lonely, and in search of fun, just like many youthful men in uniform dispatched to far-flung theaters of war. Others are less forgiving. One strand of Dear John storytelling relates to the inventive forms of payback servicemen devised in order to get the final word or last laugh in a situation which commonly left rejected men feeling powerless to do anything about a decision unilaterally made in absentia. Arthur Taylor, who served with the Third Army in World War II, devised a ruse to guilt-trip his ex-girlfriend into believing his life was in mortal danger during the Battle of the Bulge. For his part, World War II veteran Claude Orville Bryant relates an anecdote told by many other veterans of later wars. about how a Dear John'd buddy gathered together as many photos of other men's girlfriends as he could muster, put them in an envelope, and told her, "I haven't seen you in a long time. I forgot what you look like." Some men never received a Dear John. Instead, they found out at a remove that they'd been replaced in a wife or girlfriend's affections, informed by third parties, and sometimes only after demobilization. Theodore Cummings, who served with the Marine Corps in World War II, received a press cutting from his mother, who thought he should see it, about his girlfriend's marriage to another man while he was away. Jim Wayne returned from his 13-month stint as a Marine in Vietnam to learn that his high school sweetheart had married someone else. The news was broken by her father, Lafayette, Indiana's first black police officer, when Wayne knocked at the door of the family home, eager to see his girlfriend. Whatever else about military service was defined by race, receipt of a Dear John transcended ethnic divisions. Other veterans interviewed for the Veterans History Project were themselves third parties or bystanders to comrades' heartbreak. Dr. Theodore Ning, a medic in Vietnam, relates the expertise he developed in coaxing distressed, often severely intoxicated, servicemen away from the abyss as they reeled from the impact of a Dear John. Nurses like Ilsa Hansen Cooper, who served in Vietnam, detail the emotional care they devoted to distraught men suffering self-inflicted wounds. Meanwhile, some female veterans offer telling reminders that they too received letters from boyfriends and fiancés that severed romantic ties during their wartime deployment, experiences far less commonly or sympathetically memorialized in popular culture. Toby Newman, interviewed in 2015, not only recollected how her boyfriend had cavalierly dumped her while she was serving in the Women's Army Corps, quote, "You wanted to be free, now you're free," but showed her interviewer the letter. Unlike most male veterans, she had preserved her Dear Jane as tangible proof of an otherwise invisible war wound. Decades removed from active duty, several veterans reminisce about Dear Johns as heralding an upturn in their romantic fortunes. Breakup notes freed them from an unsatisfactory union to meet the one for whom they were truly destined, the short-term sting of abandonment replaced by the soft glow of decades-long marital contentment. Perspective is everything, but in contrast to these retrospective validations of destiny working itself out in the fullness of time, Kenneth Brown tells of a life fortuitously and swiftly saved by a Dear John. The most elaborate story I found in the Veterans History Project, it affirms the peculiar workings of fate in the deadliest of circumstances. Editor's note, anecdote begins at the 8:45 mark in the interview. Dear John letters, like divinity, could move in mysterious ways. All right, that's enough for that article. Up next, an article from Military Times. You are always in my heart. A look at love letters from World War II. On June 12, 1944, Joseph Jerry Brenner was training at Camp Forest in Tennessee, preparing to deploy to Europe with the U.S. Army's 740th Field Artillery Battery and the rest of the Third Army as part of the Great Crusade to end the tyranny of Nazi Germany. Like most GIs, he was lonely and missed his family, wife Norma and baby Lori back in Brooklyn, New York. The corporal's day brightened considerably at mail call when he received several letters from home. One dated June 10th was from Norma, along with details about his three-month-old daughter. The letter included a tender expression of love from his wife, the bright red lipstick smudge of a kiss. Underneath it, she penned the words, "Darling, I really kissed the paper, and it was quite without a kick. I'd much rather it were your lips." Brenner wrote back later that day, "I just kissed your lips. It was almost as good." For as long as the United States has been going to war, love letters have comforted soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines serving on the front lines. These passionate, purposeful messages serve as reminders of why they shipped off to a foreign land to face the horrors of combat, to protect and defend their loved ones. The Library of Congress includes tens of thousands of love letters in its massive Veterans History Project collection in Washington. For Valentine's Day, Military Times delved into some of these missives and their impact on maintaining morale and spirit among troops in World War II. Jerry and Norma Brenner exchanged some 1,200 letters, said Travis Bickford, the project's head of communications and an Army veteran. They were prolific. They wrote each other every day, sometimes twice a day. It's a topic that really touches home. You realize just how much communication back home matters. It's not just fundamental, it is literally necessary. In 1944, Private First Class Sumner Grant was thousands of miles away from his fiancée, Helen Abramsky, in the Bronx, New York. Guarding the Panama Canal, he served in Battery A of the 906th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion with the Panama Coast Artillery Command. The former architecture and design student expressed his love by painting watercolor illustrations of his military activities and other scenes on the envelopes of his letters home. The Sumner Grant collection in the Veterans History Project includes nearly 150 envelopes featuring the colorful and amusing depictions of life in the U.S. Army. All show exaggerated examples of Army life in humorous detail with a brief printed description such as, "This is the Army," or "Dreaming of Furlough," and "You are always in my heart." Following his death in 2000, Helen donated the collection to the Library of Congress in memory of her husband, whom she married in 1945. People can go online and view these individual resources of Sumner Grant, said Project Director Monica Mohindra. You can see exactly how he tried to bridge that physical gap. Veterans have told us that being able to communicate in these ways gave them a sense of connectivity. It wasn't just something for the person receiving it. It means a lot to them. Serving in the military was probably the last thing Ralph Samuel Jafe expected in 1944. The owner of a hardware store in Newport, Rhode Island, was 37 and balding, with arthritic knees. Plus, he had a wife, Betty, and two teenagers, Rita and Stanley. Then he received his draft notice. Jafe trudged off to war, enduring the grueling trials of physical training at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and then serving as a mail clerk in Manila a few months after the Philippine city was liberated by Allied forces in 1945. He and his wife exchanged nearly 600 letters. Private First Class Jafe explained how struggling to keep up with 18-year-old draftees who were more interested in liquor and women. "I must be a writing fool," he penned in one letter home to his wife. "All the boys are shooting dice and playing poker, while I sit and write all day long. I save you for the last, because you're in most of my heart." Betty, who took over running the hardware store, asked about ordering supplies and telling him how she longed to be seen with him in uniform. "You see, I'm so proud of you. I want to show you off," she wrote on the distinctive letterhead of Jafe's shop in Newport. The Veterans History Project collects, preserves, and makes accessible the firsthand recollections of individuals who served from World War I through recent conflicts and peacekeeping missions. To date, it has gathered more than 121,000 stories and oral histories, offering personal perspectives on what it means to serve in the U.S. military. One of the things that makes the Veterans History Project so compelling is that these are the personal expressions of real people, Mohindra said. Each of these individuals is sharing the plight of their extremely personal experience, thinking about their loved ones. To me, the real power comes from the notion that these are very unique individual experiences that, one by one, become a collective chorus of what is universal feeling of longing. Few of the correspondents in the collection stand out like Nora's lipstick-smudged letter. The pair of red lips are unusual today because the military banned the use of lipstick, known as the Scarlet Scourge, on letters sent via Victory Mail during World War II. The waxes and oils in the cosmetic, jammed equipment used to convert letters into microfilm for ease of shipping mail overseas to the troops. The visual impact of the red lips are striking, not just for the image, but for what it represents. The pain of a long separation over thousands of miles brought on by a deadly conflict that could result in the tragic end of the relationship. Reading through the letters, There is a sense of foreboding, longing, and loneliness, but also of hope and promise for a better tomorrow. In one of his letters home, Jerry Brenner wrote about the emotions probably felt by every person in the military longing to return to his or her loved ones. "I do know that your love is strong. All I can say to you is that we are one, one in body and soul. Until we are together again, we cannot live. Love always, Jerry." All right, and lastly, in keeping with the themes of letters from home, I would like to read some selections from this post to the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, Carrying the Mail, Honoring the Resilience of the 688th Postal Battalion. It's a fitting time to reflect on the remarkable stories of those who came before us, especially the courageous women of the 688th Central Postal Directory Battalion, highlighted in Tyler Perry's recent Netflix film, The 688. Just like the beginning of a new year symbolizes fresh starts and renewed determination, the sacrifices and achievements of these women resonate with the profound spirit of resilience and hope that often accompanies this season. Imagine those soldiers during World War II, awaiting letters from home, a simple message that could lift their spirits and remind them of the love and support waiting back. Much like our hopes and goals at the start of a new year, those words carried immense significance. The 688th worked tirelessly to ensure that connection remained strong, overcoming adversity and prejudice to fulfill their mission. As we set our intentions for the year ahead, let's take a page from the lives of Alice Dixon, Fanny Griffin, McClendon, and Violet Hill Gordon. They exemplified determination and purpose in even the toughest circumstances. Their journeys remind us that, just as we gather our strength to face our own challenges, we too can forge connections and impact the lives of those around us. Now, I hope you've enjoyed today's program. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you once again for tuning into Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your host, signing out.